Welcome to Sullivan & Cromwell's podcast series, S&C Critical Insights. I'm Renata Hesse, a partner in S&C's litigation group and co-head of the antitrust group. This is the second episode in the three-part series discussing recent developments in merger practice at the antitrust division of the U.S. Department of Justice and at the Federal Trade Commission. In today's episode, we're going to talk about merger clearance. With me today is Samantha Hines, an associate in our litigation group who also focuses on antitrust. Good afternoon, Sam.
Good afternoon, Renata. In our last episode, we talked about new changes in merger practice, such as model letters, model timing agreements, and the privilege review process, and how it contributes to a lengthier merger clearance. Can you expand on that? Why is it that merger clearance is taking longer now than before?
That's a good question. It's become a little less predictable when a dispute will arise. And that means it's a little hard to know where you have resolved your matter. And in the past, I think people felt that they had a fairly clear picture by the time the career staff was done with the investigation of what the direction of the investigation was and how things were going to play out. Was it going to be likely cleared? Were you going to have to do a fix of some sort? What kind of fix if you were going to have to do a fix? Were you going to need an upfront buyer? All of those questions were not resolved ultimately because the decision maker is obviously the head of the division and the commission. But at least I think people felt comfortable that they were getting pretty good and clear signals about the direction that the resolution would take. I think there's been a bit of the growing pains of having a new commission and a new front office at DOJ has been a little bit less certainty about where you are with the leadership of the two agencies, even when you seem to feel that you know where you are with the staff of the two agencies. And even at the FTC, the commissioners seem to be more involved than ever before. So the director of the Bureau of Competition, Bruce Hoffman, gave a speech not too long ago in which he said, quote, "I would not assume that even if you convince the Bureau, that is Bruce and his team, that you will convince the commissioners that a complex remedy in a case that otherwise shows significant risk is sufficient." So that signals to parties that the commission may yet have issues, even if the Bureau signs off on a resolution of a complex matter. And that just increases the lack of predictability that parties have going into a transaction.
So what can parties do to protect against that risk? Is there a way that they can get insight into the way that a front office is thinking or FTC commissioners are thinking earlier on in the process?
It's actually a good question because the agencies both, and for good reason, you know, have a fairly structured way that they review transactions, and they don't typically like it when parties try to go around the staff and get a read from the commission or the front office at DOJ before the staff is done with their investigation. So generally, I think parties need to work with the staff as best as they can, but also I think ask the staff how much involvement the front office has in the discussions. Are things being vetted with the front office before they're being brought back to the parties? And where there are real issues, I think people should not be afraid to try to take those up, not behind the staff, career staff's back, of course, but take those up to either the Bureau or the front office at DOJ. You do find sometimes that people are hesitant to ask a question above the staff's head, but my view has always been, and this is true for when I worked in the government as the acting assistant attorney general, that as long as people are transparent with the staff about what they're doing, that it doesn't harm you to try to get an answer to a question that you feel like you're not getting answered from the career staff. It doesn't always yield results, but you won't do yourself any harm by doing it as long as you're transparent in taking that step.
So, Renata, earlier you mentioned that the agencies are increasingly requiring upfront buyers in the remedy process. Are there any other trends in merger remedies?
So there's definitely been a lot of discussion about merger remedies. I mean, from the very beginning of the new administration, or at least from the time that Machen Delrahim was appointed and confirmed as the assistant attorney general, the division began talking about not being willing to use behavioral remedies and only wanting to use structural remedies. So there's been a lot of activity in this area. And in September, Machen Delrahim announced that the DOJ was going to be taking a close look at its remedies policy. and it withdrew the 2011 Policy Guide to Merger Remedies and is operating now under the 2004 Policy Guide to Merger Remedies, which is far more critical of behavioral remedies. That's completely consistent with what he said when he came on board at the division. And I should note that the FTC has also said similar things about behavioral remedies and the preference for structural remedies. The FTC's 2017 Merger Remedies Report reviewed the success of consent decrees issued from 2006 to 2012 and found that, quote, all of the divestitures involving an ongoing business succeeded, which has led to an emphasis on divesting ongoing businesses. I will say that the desire to have structural remedies as the resolution of merger matters is not a new thing. They are much easier to monitor and enforce, and I think generally it's long been the view of the agencies that structural remedies, where they work and where they're possible, work better. The division and the FTC have really focused on this ongoing business designation, though, in a way that I think other at other times has not been quite so much of a focus, although, again, from my time leading the division, I will say that there, we always had a real desire to make sure that the assets that were being sold could be taken by the buyer and operated in an ongoing way.
So if the agencies are switching more to requiring divestitures of ongoing businesses, does that mean that two companies combining can't keep the best of their two operations and divest, say, a mix and match of assets that overlap?
So I think it will be much harder for companies to do that and for remedies that are mix and match to succeed. Now, you know, in Baker Hughes Halliburton, that came up, and this was reviewed during the time that Bill Baer was the Assistant Attorney General at the Antitrust Division. And one of the criticisms of the remedies that Baker Hughes and Halliburton had proposed was a mix and match type remedy, and DOJ at that time rejected it. But I think we do see a real focus on this ongoing business, clean sweep kind of divestiture that has just, it seems to have, you know, kind of been taken up a notch from the prior administration. The DOJ has also adopted some new terms in recent consent decrees that enhance its ability to enforce its settlements. So by agreement with the parties, it has purported to lower the evidentiary standard to prove civil contempt for violation of a consent decree from clear and convincing evidence to a preponderance of the evidence. This would obviously make it easier for DOJ to show contempt than the actual civil contempt standard requires. And they've also required, again, by agreement with the parties, defendants to pay DOJ's attorney's fees, expert fees, and other costs that the DOJ has incurred relating to successful consent decree enforcement efforts. So I think these are designed to both make enforcement of decrees easier and also to make it more costly to parties to kind of play fast and loose with the terms of a consent decree. Another thing that we've seen are these global hold separate orders that prohibit integration until divestitures are completed. And we've seen those in two recent transactions, both of which were done by Sullivan & Cromwell, Bayer Monsanto and Praxair Linda. So there's a real question here about whether or not these global hold separates are going to become more prevalent, or whether these were just two transactions where the complexity of the remedies and the breadth of the remedies was so significant that the agencies, one Bayer Monsanto at DOJ and the other Praxair Linda at the FTC, that both agencies felt that they needed a global hold separate. Thank you for listening to S&C Critical Insights. Stay tuned for the next and last episode in our antitrust series. For more information about our practice, please visit us on the web at www.solcrom.com.